Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
Early in his presidency, Joe Biden set a goal. By the 4th of July, 2021, he wanted 70% of Americans to have received at least one dose of the COVID vaccine. But as summer rolled into fall, the president faced a fact that the country was going to fall short of that goal. So, on September 9th, Biden flexed his federal power and took on a new tone.
We've been patient. But our patience is wearing thin, and your refusal has cost all of us.
President Biden announced a new COVID battle plan. It includes a new COVID mandate that covers 100 million American workers. Private employers with more than 100 employees now have to require their workers get vaccinated.
We have the tools to combat the virus. If we can come together as a country and use those tools, if we raise our vaccination rate, protect ourselves and others with masking, expanded testing, and identify people who are infected, we can and we will turn the tide on COVID-19.
Good afternoon. My name is Howard Buchholz. I'm in the state of South Carolina.
Howard is one of many On Point listeners who called to say they're not budging.
As long as there are people that are excluded from it, like Congress, I don't know the reason why Congress would be excluded from it. Why are they excluded from it? That makes people like me and everyone else wonder, what is in this vaccine? Why are we taking it?
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The Biden administration isn't the first tasked with convincing Americans to get vaccinated. Take this public service announcement from 1964.
This is the virus. A tiny organism less than 1/1,000,000th of an inch in diameter. And this, the vaccine itself, the end product of medicine's long match with measles.
As a historian of medicine, if you ask me what the top 10 greatest hits of medicine are, at least 9 of them would be all these vaccines.
Medical historian Howard Markle says there's a long history of vaccine resistance in the United States, and turning the tide has been made harder due to another particularly American trait, the local control of public health.
In 1892, there was another cholera pandemic that was headed towards New York, and President Harrison closed the port, but he could only add to the days of the quarantine that the state would quarantine those ships because that was a New York State-controlled quarantine station. So that led to what was called the National Quarantine Act of 1893, which meant the president in a contagious crisis could not subtract from what the state or the local city did, but it could add to that. Then later on, there was the 1944 Public Health Act that gave the president broad powers in case of a contagious crisis. There's even a Supreme Court precedent, Jacobson versus the state of Massachusetts in 1905. Henning Jacobson was a pastor in Cambridge. He did not want to take a mandatory smallpox vaccine. They were generally made, those vaccines, by city or state health departments. They were pretty safe, but this is 1905. United States Supreme Court, I believe was 7-2, voted, no, you don't have the right to opt out of something like this because we're talking about a community-acquired infection. And so there's even a United States Supreme Court precedent for this, and there's plenty of local and state precedents. And of course, there were vaccine mandates. You know, most of the vaccines up until relatively recently pertained to children. As a pediatrician, there was a battery of vaccines I gave to newborns, to 15-month-olds, to, you know, one-year-olds, and so on. And they had a little, if you will, a passport, a cardboard piece of paper that the pediatrician would sign his or her, their name and the date and the vaccine. And that child, or really their mom, sometimes their dad, had to take that little cardboard document, when they started kindergarten. It didn't matter if it was the city of Baltimore, this is the mid-80s, or city of Detroit, you had to have that. But as the 80s proceeded, there were more and more exemptions in various state governments for vaccines to opt out, not just religion, but philosophical reasons. That kind of exemption led to, for example, the outbreak of measles in Disneyland in 2014, because less than half the kids in Orange County, California, were vaccinated against measles. So I find this antipathy to this wonderfully safe and effective preventative, but people saying it's my liberty, it's my rights. People say, well, I'll just get sick with it and I'll come out the other end. But we're living in 2021, not 1921. We have all these great tools, medicinals, and preventives. Why would you want to get sick with this? And because it's a Russian roulette kind of a disease, I can't tell if your COVID infection is going to make you foggy for the next several months, or my COVID is going to land me in an ICU. The most predictable thing about COVID-19 is its unpredictability. So to me, it's all about, and this is my training as a pediatrician, it's all about prevention. I can't understand, because of my training and work, why we would not take care of this as if it were a threat, which is what it is, a threat to the health of our nation. It's nothing less.
That's Howard Markle, director of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan. His new book coming out next week is called The Secret of Life: Rosalind Franklin, James Watson, Francis Crick, and the Discovery of DNA's Double Helix. So, the big question for today is, what is the place where smart public health decisions, the exercise of federal power, and protecting civil liberties all meet? Well, helping us to navigate that complexity is Nita Farahani. She's a professor of law and philosophy at Duke University, also co-editor-in-chief and co-founder of the Journal of Law and the Biosciences. And she joins us from Durham, North Carolina. Professor Farahani, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, you heard Howard there talk about what he sees as a long legal history justifying President Biden's new vaccine mandate for American employees. Do you agree with him that there is ample proof that this is a legal exercise of federal power?
Well, that's the important part, the word federal there, right? So there's certainly ample precedent for the exercise of state and localities implementing vaccine mandates. In fact, we have plenty of them at the state and local levels for childhood vaccinations and for other purposes. But there is no precedent on point that I'm aware of for a federal mandate, nor any precedent for the legal right of the federal government to reach into every state and to require citizens of those states to become vaccinated. I wish there were. I think it would be great in some ways. Not really, because it creates a lot of complications, especially if there's some policy I don't like that's being handed down at the federal level. In this instance, I wish it were true that we could somehow force everybody to get vaccinated, but that's not going to get us out of the pandemic, and that's not the right answer here.
So why is it not true? Tell me a little bit more about that, because I was thinking about specifically in the realm of health care decisions that Americans make. This is not a parallel example, but I was thinking about the Affordable Care Act, right? That is a federal law, but it's exercised through commerce, right? Because it has to do with health insurance, which the federal government can regulate commerce here. And this is a mandate that's not going through commerce. It's going through OSHA, right?
Right. So, it's absolutely true that the federal government has power, and it has power that it can exercise in the states through its power of interstate commerce. And one of the clever things about this particular approach was to try to say, hey, if you're an employer with more than 100 employees and trying to exercise this through OSHA, that this is what the standard of workplace safety would require. This is what the standard is necessary, is that everybody has to get vaccinated. The difference is, and of course, let's be clear, it's not that everybody has to get vaccinated. It's that employers who have more than 100 employees either have to require vaccination or regular testing. And so there is an alternative that's offered as well. The problem is we don't have any precedents of reaching in and affecting individual citizens, right? This is a reach through from the federal government through employers to require individuals do something. And that individuals do something is to do something that they may not otherwise consent to, or they may not otherwise wish to do, which is to get vaccinated. That kind of public health decision-making is something that, as between the power between the federal government and the states, is delegated to the states and is generally exercised by the states, recognizing that there may be differences state by state or community by community as to what makes the most sense for public health policies at those levels. So it's creative. It's going to be litigated. It is unprecedented. And maybe there will be some courts that uphold it at the federal level, given the alternative that's being offered of testing or vaccination. But I'd be very surprised if at the end of the day, this is a policy that stands the test of constitutionality.
So to be clear, are you saying that this particular reach of federal power has never happened before?
Not that I am aware of. I am not aware of a single instance of a federally mandated vaccine.
Okay. Fascinating. Because I'm just thinking about, again, the key thing is federal power here, right? There would be no question if a state mandated exactly the same thing, would there?
No, there's no question. And in fact, I mean, you know, we have constitutional law on this matter, which, there have been challenges historically, way back now, to states who have enacted mandatory vaccinations for childhood or for other purposes. And the Supreme Court has upheld those and said it is absolutely within the power of the state to require it as a condition, for example, of attending public school or as a condition of employment in a hospital or some other setting. The question is whether or not the executive has the power to require citizens in states to become vaccinated.
Okay. We've just got about 30 seconds before our first break here. But Professor Farahani, let me ask you, the another part of the question is, what power does the federal government have to prevent harm, right? I mean, there are laws in which employees cannot do certain things because they harm fellow employees. Could a vaccine mandate not be seen in that context?
Well, I mean, it's absolutely within the federal government's power to set minimum standards for workplace safety. And you could look at this as workplace safety, given the alternatives that are set up. But it is certainly, a different cry than the kind of protections that have been put into place until now.
Well, we'll have a lot more to discuss, when we come back. So, Professor Nita Farahani, stand by. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're taking a close look at President Biden's new COVID plan, including that vaccine mandate that employers who have more than 100 workers start mandating the COVID vaccine for their employees or provide regular testing. And we'll talk about that testing piece in detail a little bit later in the show. But we're asking, what is the place where effective public health decisions, the exercise of federal power, and the protection of civil liberties all meet? Does that space actually exist in the United States. I'm joined today by Nita Farahani. She's co-editor-in-chief and co-founder of the Journal of Law and Biosciences. She's a professor of law and philosophy at Duke University. And here's a little bit more from President Joe Biden's September 9th announcement of his sweeping new COVID plan.
My message to unvaccinated Americans is this. What more is there to wait for? What more do you need to see? We've made vaccinations free, safe, and convenient. The vaccine has FDA approval. Over 200 million Americans have gotten at least one shot. We've been patient, but our patience is wearing thin, and your refusal has cost all of us.
On Point listener Jason from Georgia called us to say this is how he would respond to President Biden.
I'm not going to take a vaccine. I'm just, you know, the way he threatened people, his patience is wearing thin. I think I'll just sit around and wait and see what happens. I'm wondering what his next move is.
And here's listener Laura from Des Moines, Iowa, who works at a hospice facility. She told us that nurses are the largest group of unvaccinated employees on her team, and her company is encouraging employees to get vaccinated, but so far has stopped short of mandating it.
It appears they are waiting for the government to be the bad guy so they don't have to be. I am pro-vaccine, but my feelings are torn when it comes to the mandate. I have already seen one of our facilities lose half a dozen aides, and that was just from one memory care unit. I worry that we will see a nursing and aide shortage like we've never seen before. On the plus side, it seems like the employment options for unvaccinated healthcare workers will be few and far between.
That's Laura, an On Point listener from Des Moines, Iowa. Well, joining us now from Washington is Lawrence Gostin. He's founding chair in global health law at Georgetown University School of Law and also the director of the World Health Organization's Collaborating Center on National and Global Health Law. Lawrence Gostin, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So you heard Nita Farahani lay out her reasons why she's concerned about the legality of Biden's sort of new employee or employer-based mandate for the COVID-19 vaccine. But on the other hand, is there an argument to say that in the United States, because of how healthcare is done, the workplace is the best place for such a mandate?
Well, I think actually that's true as a matter of public health and policy, because we're virtually unique in the United States that we organize our health coverage at the employer level. That doesn't meet the legal argument, though. Let me just try to take a step back. Howard Markel, a very good friend, talked about Jacobson versus Massachusetts in 1905. Jacobson gives a broad right and power of the states and the cities to mandate vaccines. But it's a wide misconception in the United States that it gives the federal government that right. Mm-hmm. But I do think that President Biden is actually on rock solid legal ground. And he is because he's acting at the very height of presidential power. He's not acting unilaterally. He's acting through a specific and clear delegation of authority from the Congress of the United States. In 1970, the Congress passed the Occupational Safety and Health Act. And it did so because there was a weak patchwork of state laws that were making it hard to have workplace safety. And so it gave the president power to set national uniform standards through the Department of Labor. That's what he's doing here. And I should just say one thing. You know, people say an infectious disease is different than a workplace injury. But the truth is that the threat that the Delta variant places in a crowded workspace is every bit as great as the threat of a workplace injury, and probably much greater.
Well, let me just give Nita Farahani a chance to respond to that. What do you say?
I think it's a creative approach. Look, I mean, I think that the mandatory testing, that he's on solid ground to be able to do so, I think that that could be argued in some way as premises security. If you look at other standards that have been passed through OSHA, the vaccine requirement goes a step further than has ever been taken before. We can require people to wear safety goggles or safety equipment. We can require people to, we can require employers to implement measures that make the workplace safe for other people. But requiring that somebody take a vaccine, and again, this one gives you the alternative. You either have to be vaccinated or you have to be tested. Requiring that somebody take a vaccine would go farther than anything that I think could be justified under OSHA or any other standard for the federal government. And besides that, I think my bigger concern is I think this will backfire from all of the people who are calling in. You hear this from all of the research that looks at why is there vaccine hesitancy and everything that looks at what is most likely to move the needle for the remaining people who have not been vaccinated. There may be a few people at the margin whose livelihood is so threatened that they feel like their only alternative is to get vaccinated. But for the most part, what this will do is just simply further entrench the divide between the vaccinated and the unvaccinated and lead people to dig in their heels, increase mistrust of the federal government, and perpetuate this problem that we have today, which is vaccine hesitancy that has now become so deeply politicized.
Mm. So I want to take note that actually the legal arguments, pro and con, are absolutely fascinating to me, and we could probably spend the whole hour on them. But for now, let's just say that we will see how those legal arguments play out in court, because certainly this is going to court. But the next big question, though, is, okay, as Professor Farahani has pointed out, how effective is this mandate going to be? And Lawrence Gostin, I'll turn to you on that. But let me just read a comment here that we've got from one of our listeners online. Hope Van Deest sent us this message saying, most people I've talked to who are not getting vaccinated are not doing it to own the libs or because they don't trust the media. They are not doing it because they don't trust government institutions like the FDA or CDC. This is a trust issue, a poverty issue, and a fear issue. Those issues are not healed with mandates, demeaning language, or even reason. Trust in institutions must be rebuilt with transparency and, frankly, getting corporate interests out of those institutions. How do you respond to that, Lawrence Gostin?
Well, I think it's a legitimate point, and you need both. You need to be kind and compassionate and caring. And you shouldn't use vaccines or a vaccine mandate as a form of punishment or blame. And we've seen too much of that on the left. I'm a huge supporter of what President Biden has done, and I've worked closely with the White House COVID team. The one thing I did not like what I heard from President Biden is the idea that we've lost patience, we're fed up, now we're forcing you. That's not the message that I would want to leave. What I would say is that compulsory vaccinations have been part of American society ever since the earliest days of the Republic. Mm. Soon after Jenner actually even discovered that, you know, cowpox inoculations could prevent smallpox, we've seen this throughout the United States. We've also seen that mandates do get a lot of pushback, but ultimately they boost and maintain very high vaccination rates. We've seen that, for example, with childhood vaccinations. When France started its pass sanitaire, which required vaccination as a condition of doing most of the things you love in France, there were protests in the streets. But within days, there were additional 3 to 5 million people, in addition to who would have got vaccinated. And so vaccine mandates actually work. They're not blame. They're not punishment. They're very much part of the American culture, and they've worked historically, and I think they will this time as well.
Mm. Well, Professor Farahani, I'm going to come back to you in a second on that. But, you know, we did want to also hear from an employer right, who is going to, they are on the receiving end of this mandate to effect it upon their employees. So we spoke to someone who has more than 100 workers. His name is Tom Young, and he's got a lot to say. He's the founder and brewmaster at Great Basin Brewing Company in Reno, Nevada.
We have a saying at the brewery that it's our job here to make this planet a better place one pint at a time. We kind of live by that. It's a little bit cliche, but we all have to, you know, buckle up and try to do what we think is right.
Now, the pandemic has been hard on Tom's business. At one point, he had to lay off half of his 120 employees. And at other times, he didn't have enough staff because of COVID infections or exposure.
We and other businesses have had a fair amount of COVID. I mean, we had some of our hostesses, four more of the same sorority. They all go to a party kind of last year. And about 4 days later, all four of them had fevers and coughs or out. We need hostesses to work. For a while, we had absolutely no kitchen personnel for our morning grill or to the restaurants because of COVID outbreaks that happened and despite our social distancing and things like that, too.
So when the vaccines were first given emergency authorization, Tom was thrilled. He couldn't wait to make an appointment for himself. And then, because he says public service is central to his business, he looked for ways to get his community vaccinated, too.
We decided to do what we can, roll up our sleeves, and we're not forcing anyone to get a vaccine. But if you need a little nudge, let's make it fun. Come to one of our breweries and we do a shot of beer where you get a vaccine. You could pick from the Janssen or the Pfizer vaccine and get a shot in the arm. And we reward you after you waited your allotted time for 15 minutes to get a nice pint of beer. And it turned out to be a very successful event in our first one. They were doing a poll to see how many vaccines they would possibly give out to things too. And my own wife thought we would administer two, which was very disappointing to me, you know, too. But the first clinic, we did 110, and we're very proud to do that. And, you know, it really is about saving lives.
And Tom told us that several hundred people have attended the brewery vaccine events, but there are still people on his own staff who decline to get vaccinated. So that's why he actually hopes the Biden mandate will help.
From a human standpoint, no one likes to mandate something. Because we want people to understand the utility and practicality of doing something. So I just kind of appreciated it coming from the federal government because, you know, it gives us a little bigger leg to stand on than a local business trying to mandate it. As I said, I can put my hat on, but I also think that our employees are so important to our business and they've been so important to the success of our local small business we have here in Reno, Nevada, that I have to respect their opinions, too.
That's Tom Young, founder and brewmaster at Great Basin Brewing Company in Reno, Nevada. Nita Farahani, what do you make of Tom there in Reno saying that, in a sense, this federal mandate gives him cover to do what he you know, liked to do anyway, but simply couldn't before?
Yeah, I mean, so first of all, let me make clear, I am a huge vaccine proponent. I was in the Moderna trial. I was probably one of the first people in the world vaccinated. And I think what he is doing is terrific with respect to giving people a shot or a beer and trying to give them agency and comfort and increase trust in the community and to make a community event out of vaccination. I think that's a great pathway forward to try to help people who are vaccine hesitant find community and be more comfortable about getting vaccinated. I'm also empathetic to the idea that many of us, myself included, I have two small children at home, are impatient and we're looking for cover and we want somebody to make it better, some way to find a way to get to vaccine hesitant people. I mean, I think I've heard people say, like, if I could just hold people down and put the vaccine in them, that would really help. That's just not the way we operate, unfortunately. That is, and not really unfortunately,
fortunately.
Fortunately, right? I mean, we respect individual liberties. And in the long run, we're going to have boosters. We're going to have probably different shots that we're going to need as this vaccine mutates. We're going to need a way that isn't just forcing people to get vaccinated, but trying to help restore trust in our public health institutions to help people understand the value of the vaccine, and doing so by continuing to politicize it, continuing to do things that are strong arming people to try to get them to take the vaccine isn't going to lead us out of the pandemic in the short run or in the long run. And so I get it. I'm empathetic. I know people want cover. I don't think the cover is going to move the needle enough, and it's not going to help us in the long run.
Okay, so Lawrence Gossin, this gets us back to, again, the second key question that I've got for this hour is, again, how effective do you think this will be? If people can opt out by either quitting their jobs or getting regular testing, is it going to move the needle enough, as Professor Farahani has put it, to get enough more people vaccinated to make a meaningful difference in pandemic control in this country?
Well, you've just said something very important, which suggests that this isn't holding somebody down and putting a needle in them, or even a vaccine mandate. You have a choice to be vaccinated or to be tested, to work at that workplace or not to work at that workplace. And it's absolutely true, as a matter of ethics and American values and philosophy, that everyone has the right to make the decision that they would wish to make for their own health and safety. But you absolutely do not have the right to impose a potentially grave, if not lethal, risk on other people. No one has the right to go into a very crowded workspace unmasked and unvaccinated. That is not a right that has ever been part of American values or history or culture. And the idea in America now is my rights, my rights, my rights. And we've forgotten that we also have not just a duty to ourselves, we have a duty to our families, our communities, our neighbors, our country. We've forgotten the tradition of the common good in America.
Lawrence Gossin and Nita Farahani, stand by. More to come. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're having a terrific conversation asking the question of where effective public health decision making, the exercise of federal power, and the protection of civil liberties all come together, if they can come together in the United States. And we're looking at the Biden administration's new COVID plan, which includes that mandate for employers who have more than 100 employees to require that their employees get vaccinated or frequently get tested, that has an impact on 100 million Americans. And we're joined today by Nita Farahani. She's at Duke University and co-editor-in-chief and co-founder of the Journal of Law and the Biosciences. Lawrence Gossin joins us as well. He's at Georgetown University and director of the World Health Organization's Collaborating Center on National and Global Health Law. And Nita and Lawrence, just stick with me for a little bit because we're getting a ton of response from listeners here. For example, Katie Gifford says, my employer has, as of today, announced their intention to begin transition towards mandated vaccination. The same company issued a required signed document 30 days ago that ensured a policy of protecting employee choice and the right to non-disclosure of health information. They will lose employees. Healthcare professionals should resist any rule that violates a patient's right to refuse invasive therapy. No panelist or expert can defend an action of a mandated vaccine while still complying with the patient's Bill of Rights. On the other hand, this is Ivy, who called us from Virginia City, Virginia, and here's what she said.
I think it's great that the president is putting forward a two-pronged plan, vaccinate or test. Millions of cases would not have happened in the first place if testing was promoted along with vaccination. Rapid tests should be low cost. They are cheap to make and easy to do, or free to frontline workers and anyone not wanting to spread variants, vaccinated or not.
And here's Brooke from Reno, Nevada, who has worked through the pandemic as an Uber driver and at a grocery store. She says, nope, not going to get vaccinated.
You know, my first thought was, okay, I'm going to take my opportunity to be unemployed and either get unemployment or just take a vacation from work. I feel like I don't, it's my right to not get vaccinated if I don't want to, and I don't feel that that's the government's business to be telling me what I should and should not do with my body. I care about my fellow man, and I want the pandemic ended as soon as possible, but I don't think that's the right thing to do, to mandate corporations to do such a thing.
Lawrence Gostin, you had said earlier about you feel that Americans have forgot the importance of the common good, and people do not have a right to go into a crowded room and not wear a mask and potentially infect other people. But, you know, aside from the legal structure that's somewhat challenging in this situation, there's also, I think there's ample proof that Americans have accepted for a long time people's right to actually potentially dangerous behaviors in public. I mean, the first thing that popped to my mind is gun ownership and the legal carrying of weapons in crowded public spaces. I mean, how is this any different?
Well, you know, we actually, guns are, you know, the exception that proves the rule, because we've got the Second Amendment and it's become part of the culture. It's not part of the culture that I like. I do think that there needs to be, you know, common sense safety rules for owning a gun. But we have so many examples throughout our everyday lives about that we're regulated to do things for the public's health. We have to, we can't drink and then get in our car and drive. You can't drive as fast as you want on the highway. There are multiple rules that we take to say, listen, you can take risks with your own health. We don't encourage you to. But, you know, you can ski down a dangerous mountain if you want to, but you can't take risks that will mean that others might become injured or sick. That's not part of the right that's ever been part of the culture in the United States.
Yeah. And so, Nita Farahany, let me turn back to you on this, because I take Lawrence Gostin's point. But again, it's like these are mandates that have been enacted at the state level, and the federal government doesn't even really set highway speeds, as far as I remember. Please correct me if I'm wrong. So do you see this as potentially as kind of almost an act of desperation by the Biden administration, that what we have is a total political failure to convince lawmakers at the state level that perhaps they should take greater action to help stem the tide of the pandemic?
Yeah, let me address it on a couple different fronts, Magna. So first, we're talking about, is this appropriate for the federal government to do, as mm-hmm. opposed to, is it appropriate for individual employers like Duke University? They have a mandate for vaccination. I think that's great. They didn't do it at the command of the federal government or at the direction of the federal government. They did it because they thought it was the right thing to do for their university and for students and faculty and staff and others who are in the community. And I'm not opposed to vaccine mandates at the local, state, and employer level. I'm concerned about an overreach by the federal government to do so. But I think I am in violent agreement in some ways with Lawrence, which is the basic principle of libertarianism that seems to animate a lot of American culture, that you have a right to do whatever you want, is obviously limited by the harm principle. You can't intentionally harm other people, or once your actions start to harm other people, we have a right to put some limitations on it. The question is, what limitations and how far can those limitations be? And can the federal government be the one to exercise them? And so, you know, if you are somebody who has chosen not to get vaccinated, should you be required to wear a mask, and a good mask that is not a cloth mask that you wear beneath your nose that you are, spreading Delta or risking others? I think yes. I think that is not a high ask of you, and that states and businesses and employers ought to require that in order to prevent the spread to other people. And I think ethically, people have a duty, especially to children who are unvaccinated, to take safety precautions and measures. And I think many people have an ethical duty if they are in high-risk situations where they can't mask properly or keep social distancing properly. They really ought to think about getting a vaccination as an ethical duty to their fellow citizens. Mm. The question is, should the federal government mandate it, rather than what's the ethical duty of individuals to act conscientiously toward their fellow citizens?
I mean, in this case, all three of us are in violent agreement, because the idea that Americans ought to look out after each other, for each other, is really the key in helping to stop this pandemic. And perhaps we all individually need to do a little bit more on that front. But again, the question is, to produce that ethical behavior, is a federal mandate an effective way of doing that? But Professor Farahani, we have a listener, Corey Mack, who's asking, it seems that vaccines are akin to seatbelts. The federal government was able to require state seatbelt laws by tying highway funding to their adoption. Is there a similar federal compliance mechanism in this case?
So first of all, the history of seatbelts is actually quite interesting. There was quite a pushback against them to begin with. But that being said, just notice the difference between a shot going into your body and a seatbelt that you have to wear if you choose the privilege of driving. And I think they're different. One is a less restrictive means of promoting safety and decreasing the cost of accidents to society. And the other one is requiring that you have a medical intervention, which goes beyond what we have traditionally allowed within the power of the federal government to mandate. And again, that was controversial. I'm in favor of, having basic OSHA safety regulations and seatbelt laws and other things like that. I don't think it's the role of the federal government to mandate vaccinations, which is why they included the alternative of testing. The problem there is that there is no enforcement mechanism, no support for employers, and no information on what are they supposed to do with the testing program. Are they supposed to fire employees who get COVID because of refusal to be vaccinated? Who knows how that part's going to play out?
And also whether we have the infrastructure to deal with
right.
the rapid increase and the number of tests we're talking about.
Absolutely.
Here.
Yeah.
But so, Lawrence Gustin, it comes down to, I'm wondering about, are there other means to achieve the same goal that don't require this use of federal power? Because I think, I take Nita Farahani's point about being cautious to expand the role of the federal government, because once that genie's out of the bottle, it is very hard, if not impossible, to get it back in. So, Emily Shetler is sending us this question, saying, is increasing health insurance premiums for the unvaccinated an option, a la what Delta Airlines has done? They're adding a surcharge to premiums for their employees who don't get a COVID shot. But if I understand correctly, Professor Gustin, you're opposed to increasing health insurance premiums as a way to encourage vaccination.
Yeah, I absolutely am. Let me explain why I am, and also talk a little bit about the idea of of vaccines being a more restrictive measure, and if there are ways we can do it otherwise. You know, I think healthcare is a right. Every American should have affordable and fully accessible health coverage. I don't want to charge people more if they are a heavy drinker, if they eat the wrong foods, if they don't exercise, or if they don't get vaccinated. This is something that is very important to me, which is that we ought to give everybody full access to healthcare. I've also heard arguments we should not provide treatment for people who haven't been vaccinated, or less treatment, or put them in the back of the line. I don't agree with any of that. But listen, I've worked in public health for over 30 years. There's usually, even with smoking, there's no one tool that works. With COVID, just putting on a mask is not going to work. We've tried to mask. COVID came roaring back. We've tried to distance, the same. We've even totally locked down, and it keeps roaring back. So what we need is a layered approach. Vaccines and universal vaccine coverage comes first. That will be our most protective thing. And yes, also mask, ventilate, and test. Mm. And if we do all of those things, we're going to get the real freedom that we want. Freedom from fear, freedom to do the things that we love to do, to go to concerts, to restaurants. And this is part of it.
Yeah.
Mandates actually do work, and we should use them.
Let's hear again for a quick moment from President Biden when he made that announcement on September 9th. And here's his message to the more than 160 million Americans who have been vaccinated.
For the vast majority of you who've gotten vaccinated, I understand your anger at those who haven't gotten vaccinated. I understand the anxiety about getting a breakthrough case. But as the science makes clear, if you're fully vaccinated, you're highly protected from severe illness, even if you get COVID-19.
And here's how Jerome Adams reacted to President Biden's speech last week. You'll recall that he served as Surgeon General under President Donald Trump. Well, Adams told Wish TV in Indianapolis that he thinks Biden's intentions are good, but he is very worried about how the message was received.
One of the things that really concerned me is that you're setting up a fight between the vaccinated and the unvaccinated. And we know that minorities have legitimate reasons to be concerned about new treatments. We know that there are individuals out there, many, many females who I talk to, who have been preyed upon with misinformation about the vaccines causing infertility or miscarriage. They do not. I want to be clear. They do not. But we need to make sure we're getting those questions answered, not demonizing people, while also doing what the president was trying to do and communicating the urgency of the situation.
Former Surgeon General Jerome Adams there. So look, this is a very American situation, isn't it? Like we have the constant tension between state and federal power laid into the Constitution, quite frankly. We have the caution against the radical expansion of federal power and how hard it is to wind that back. We have the unique situation in the United States where so much of access to health care comes through employers anyway. And we have a once-in-a-century pandemic, which thus far has not shown meaningful signs of being effectively put to an end. So we've got 2 minutes left, and I'm going to give both of you a one-minute shot at this. What should we be doing now? What is the best strategy right now? Nita Farahani, your response to that.
Our best strategy is to try to work on trust in the individuals who are not vaccinated, not by forcing them to become vaccinated, but by getting out into communities, by getting out into community leaders with whom they relate, and providing them with the best possible information. We need to flood the market with accurate information to counter misinformation and disinformation and restore trust in public health agencies in order to encourage vaccine-hesitant individuals to get vaccinated. It's our best way out of the pandemic. It's the best way for people to protect themselves, and it's the best way for people to protect others. A mandate by the federal government will backfire and will prevent that kind of restoration of trust that is critical to getting us out of this mess.
I hear you, but I also can hear the voices of many listeners saying, how much more high quality information do people need than is already out there?
So much more, because the disinformation campaigns are so powerful.
Lawrence Gostin, you have the last word here in the last minute. Go ahead.
So, it's clear from a public health point of view that we need to have a layered precautions, as much vaccination as we can. We should be to 85, over 90% of our population who are eligible should be vaccinated. We should have universal masking. We should be outdoors and ventilated as much as we can. And we should test frequently to identify infection and isolate and quarantine. That is the kind of layered approach that will get us out of this. Public trust is extraordinarily important. And we need to have better health communication in the United States. Mm-hmm. And it hasn't been what it should be, but it can be.
Lawrence Gostin at Georgetown University Law School and director of the World Health Organization's Collaborating Center on National and Global Health Law. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
And Nita Farahani at Duke University and co-editor-in-chief and co-founder of the Journal of Law and the Biosciences. Professor Farahani, thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.